another edition of Expanding Mind. This is Eric Davis continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I'm reading a wonderful book right now called Lud in the Mist by Hope Mirlees, which is a classic under-the-radar fantasy in the sort of, you know, English fantasy vein, written in, I believe, in the 1920s, in Praise to the High Heavens by Neil Gaiman and other folks who really know the deal. And the takes place in this land, the city that abuts the land of fairy, but the people in the land refuse to acknowledge the existence of fairy, of their mischievous enchantments, of their magics, of their powerful psychoactive fairy fruit, and instead they hold on to the kind of stalwart values of quotidian reality. But the book is about the way that fairy is always seeping into their ordinary existence. And one of the main characters is the mayor of the town, who, when he was a young man, heard a woman sing an old tune. And in hearing that song, he heard what he calls the note. And somehow the note pierced his sort of surface of ordinary quotidian reality and introduced him to some intimacy with a secret, with a mystery that's vaguely dark, but also full of wonder and beauty. And it haunts him throughout his life. And I thought it was very interesting that the author figured this sort of memory and yearning for a fairy, for a land of enchantment, for a land of expanded consciousness, for preternatural beauty, with the figure of a note, of an unseen sound, of a pitch that seems to call from farther away than we're used to hearing. We do a lot of shows about sound, because I find sound and thinking about sound and entering into sound, entering into listening, entering into music, but also just in terms of the act of listening itself, is a marvelous way, constantly available to register, explore, and integrate the everyday experience of consciousness, including our everyday encounters with wondrous possibilities. And so today's show, we're going to be pursuing this note, pursuing listening and the physics and metaphysics of sound as part of an integral healing practice, and also as a form of inquiry into the world, of really trying to understand what's going on around us, almost sort of seeking the listening that goes through music and reaches perhaps something more fundamental, the physics of sound, the physics of consciousness. And there's been a lot of attention to sound healing, you know, for many decades in the West, and that resting on older traditions that go back powerfully through multiple world traditions of music making. But recently, I'd say there's been more of attention to sound and physics and its relationship to consciousness and its relationship to healing. And I'm very happy to say that today we have one of the more formidable figures in this movement, if you want to think of it that way, Alexander Tanous, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, who is a musicologist, educator, composer, ethnomusicologist as well. So he studies the social and cultural dimension of music in different cultures, which is a wonderful way to isolate both the more universal physics and metaphysics of sound, as well as the different ways that music functions to shape our reality, shape our personality, shape our experiences. And though he has worked a lot in the, you know, highbrow world of universities and, you know, kind of higher orders of studies, he's also himself a sound healer and has worked with thousands and thousands of individuals. And some of the results from his research is based not just on his studies into physics, into neuroscience, and into the histories of music and sound in the world, but also his own experience working with individuals who are bound up with the ongoing, ever-present possibilities and challenges of healing. So with no further ado, Alexander, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you for the invitation, Eric. Good to be here on the show.
Yes, very good. So, you know, I thought I was listening to the recording that you had sent me of a session you had done for the Evolver Network as part of a larger group of people who were teaching on sound and healing. And I thought it was it's a good place to kind of begin, though it's a long, you know, subject in its in itself. It would be great to perhaps zone in a little bit on the peculiar difference that Western music has had in terms of its physics, in terms of the way in which it has been organized, in contrast to so many other musics of the world. Because it seems like this this difference, the difference between the equal tempered scale that organizes the modern piano and our classical classical music understanding of musicology and how much music is composed and experienced in the West, that the difference between the equal tempered scale and the world of just intonation, which is based on the more on the universal physics of sound more directly and influences so many other kinds of music on the planet, that seems to be a very key part both of your vision of the potential of music to heal, but also in a way what has sort of gotten a little bit off with, let's say, the Western ear as it tries to, you know, truly listen to the world, to try to truly listen to sound, to music. So that maybe seems like a good place to kind of start off in terms of your work.
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about this. This is indeed very fascinating and very important point to address that a lot of people who work with sound overlook it. I think it's the most important topic when it comes to sound, which is the mathematics of sound. Because what sound is really, it's mathematical ratios that we're listening to. So basically, it's a very convoluted and rich topic, but I'll try to summarize it in a way that's comprehensible and without getting into jargon. They're hard to avoid, so I'm going to address some technical words, but I'll explain them to any level that's desired. So basically, the equal temperament that we've been following in the West for a few centuries was not quickly standardized. It took some time to be standardized. Equal temperament is the act of dividing the octave into 12 equidistant half steps. The octave is not always divided into 12 half steps or 12 tones, if we can call them. By the way, the half step in Western music is basically the distance between the white and the black key on the piano, the adjacent black key on the piano. It's the smallest division in the octave. Not all octaves in the world are divided into 12 tones. For example, in Indian classical music, the octave is divided into 22 tones. In Persian and Arabic classical music, the octave is divided into 24 tones. In Turkish music, it's divided into 53 tones. In Indonesian and Balinese music, you have divisions of 7 and 5 tones. So this is something that people are not aware of, and they think that other musical cultures are similar to Western musical system. Not exactly. Western musical octave and culture did impact other ancient musical cultures because of pop and rock and roll, basically, and colonization and conservatory system. But a lot of these ancient musical cultures that are still existing, there are many. Indian classical music is one, Turkish, Arabic, Persian, Central Asian, North African, so on and so forth. These are the developed musical systems. Of course, you have other musical systems in South America, in Sub-Saharan Africa, and the rest of the world, but doesn't seem like they had a very complex development and documentation and scientific aspect to them. So these ancient musical cultures use different system. We can use the term just intonation. Just intonation, that means the mathematics of the octave are different than the mathematics in the Western octave. So basically, before the equal temperament in the West, the octave was still divided into 12 tones, but they were not equidistant. So I'm going to explain this a little further. The octave, as it's divided into 1,200 cents, a cent is a unit for logarithmic measurement that physicists specialize in sound acoustics, basically, which they study the behavior of sound, and mathematicians also deal with. A cent is a really small division. So if we divide the octave into 12 equidistant half steps, then each half step will be equal to 100 cents. Now, a tiny fluctuation of little or under 100 cents may not be noticeable to the untrained ear and sometimes the trained ear as well. It's really hard to notice the difference between half step that's 102 cents and 100 cents or a little more than that. It's a really tiny difference. Most people would not object to that, but it would make a huge difference when it comes to how music impacts consciousness. For example, in these ancient musical cultures that are still existing, it's common to go in states of trance, states of euphoria, of ecstasy, of enchantment. These states are achieved through judicious, attentive listening and playing to an extent where the musicians and the audience will go into the state of trance. Why? Because the musicians are playing on instruments, non-equal tempered modes or scales. So there's also another very important layer, perhaps we can talk about it later, that it's not just the medium, it's how it's being listened to.
Yeah, no, so I think we've already got a cluster of really interesting points. One thing that pops in my head that I've always been interested in that kind of sets the sort of cultural tensions and differences in a good light is when you think about the discovery by the youth culture in the West, in America, in the 60s and 70s of other people's music. And so suddenly there becomes a fad for Indian classical music, you know, so much so right. that at Monterey Pop, where Ravi Shankar was playing, that they sat down and they basically tuned up. And then after tuning, the crowd erupted in uproarious applause because it was just the sound of these new instruments that was appealing. Now, one way that people talk about this, about the appeal of Persian music, particularly Indian music at the time, but music that had drones in it, music from folk countries. There's suddenly this influx of interest in world music from people who were young people who want to get high, want to trip out, who want to, you know, experience exotica. And one way of explaining that is simply that, oh, well, this is music of different cultures, so it appeals to their orientalism. They want to imagine the exotic or the fantastic. So they listen to other people's music, which sounds different because it has these different scales and different ways of playing with intonation, et cetera. But the more interesting response, which I think you would probably share, is that this excitement reflected an almost intuitive sense that there were physical differences in these kinds of music and in the instruments that are playing them, physical differences in the waveforms that opened up an opportunity for a different kind of listening, for a different kind of engagement, one that possibly was more allowed these other states, altered states, to grow with more facility and was certainly much more kind of a cultural heritage of that. So it seems to me there's something really precious, if sometimes misguided, but there's something very precious in the modern Western listener, perhaps not very well trained, listen to some classical music, listens to some pop music, and then discovers these other worlds of sound as something that is potentially quite meaningful emotionally and even spiritually, seems to be pointing to the difference that you're talking about.
Absolutely. You're right on with these observations. So it is the physicality of the instrument. For example, almost all Indian string instruments have three sets of strings. It's set of string that you play, that you finger. The technical word is stopping. That means you're stopping the string at a certain length to produce a certain note. And then another set of strings that you play as drones to give you the drone support to uplift the melody that you're playing on the strings that you actually play on a sitar or sarod, sarangi, so on. And another set of strings that you don't play, but they resonate in sympathetic resonance with specific notes that are being played to give a natural amplification. And these strings vibrate sympathetically because they're part of the same frequency of the note that you're playing, or the notes that are being played are part of the harmonic series. And that's another thing that we'll talk about later, very, very important part of sound, harmonic series or overtones. So this is what causes natural amplification, resonance, basically. Also, a lot of the instruments that are played, let's say string instruments in Arabic music, Persian, Turkish, they're either fretless, that means there are no divisions on the neck, in the same way violin, viola, cello, and bass have no frets, like on the guitar, basically would allow the musicians to play that note a little bit higher or a little lower. And same, there are some string instruments that are fretted, but these frets are movable. And some of these frets fall between the half steps on quarter tones, a little high, a little low, and you can actually move them. They're not fixed. They're not metallic frets that are part of the fingerboard, but rather they're wrapping of strings that you can move them up and down as you're playing an instrument, such as the sitar, the Persian sitar, and so on. So wind instruments are the same. You can underblow and overblow to give you this slightly higher or slightly lower note to fit just intonation. So what I'm very interested in as well, and you mentioned it, is the intuitive sense. We, of course, you know, people centuries ago or thousands of years ago didn't have electricity, they didn't have technology or ways to measure frequencies, but they did everything through intuition. And this is very important because you end up by dealing with a lot of difficult concepts that are exemplified in these ancient musical cultures, and you would think that, my God, this is completely scientific method of working with sound, with music, like in Indian classical music and the other cultures that I mentioned, how could they arrive to such things? Well, this is what we do as human beings. We don't need to know specifics. We just need to have intention and time, practice, and it's as if there is an inner compass in us that would guide us toward where we need to go to eventually learn something about consciousness, because sound is the most versatile tool when it comes to using it in various contexts of healing, trance, sacred, religious, secular, spiritual, and so on. It's been used as a powerful vehicle for transcendence, to expand consciousness, to learn something about the invisible landscape. And this is something that happened in Judaic, Christian, Islamic music, except these three religions capitalize on the power of sound tremendously. That's something that I often address and give examples. But to go back to where we started from, that yes, the instruments are different. It's not just exhaust music. There are many things that are different, and there's a commonality that you would find between all of these ancient musical cultures. A, drone, the use of drone. Second, B is basically using non-harmonic systems. The harmonic system that we have in the West, which is called tertial harmony, that means you build intervals based on thirds. to give you an example, if you want to build a chord on the C note, the next note, if you're building a C major chord, then you pick E and G. This will give you C major chord. And the distance between C and E is a third, C, D, E. And then E, F, G, that's another third. But they're different thirds. The first third is called major third, which has four half steps, versus the second, the upper third, is a minor third, which has three half steps. So this will give you C major chord. If you want to make this chord minor, then you lower the E to become E flat, and then you have minor third on the bottom and major third on top. Or you can make it diminished third by stacking two minor thirds, or you can make it an augmented chord, which gives you two major thirds on top of each other. And same thing will go on, starting on D, D sharp, and so on. If you want to play seventh chord or ninth, 11th, and 13th, you stack more thirds on top, which is what you get when you deal with jazz. And some pop rock music, mostly jazz, really, and late 19th century, 20th century classical music. So this you don't find in ancient musical culture. They use different harmonic system, more basic but yet complicated, and using the order that one would find in the harmonic series. So another thing that you would find in this ancient musical culture is the use of ornamentation, the decoration around the notes. Like in Indian music, a note, when it's sung or played, is not precise, moving from one note to another. They often go a little over and a little under to give you the nuances. Another thing that you would find in ancient musical culture is, this is one of the most important parts, which we miss out on in the West, which is the use of modes. Modes are comparable to scales, but modes have an ethos. An ethos is the distinguishing character, distinguishing personality or spirit of a mode. To give you an example, in Western music, when people listen to a piece of music composed in a major key, any major key, oftentimes people describe it as happy, gives them feeling of being happy, lighthearted, easygoing. Minor can sound more romantic, sad. There's a sense of lament and nostalgia, spooky to some. So we in the West, we tend to focus more on the ascending and descending pattern of a scale, whereas if you ask a musician from an ancient musical culture to play or sing you a specific mode, this musician would not play that mode in an upward and descending motion scale-wise. No, they will extemporize short composition. They would improvise a melody to allow you to feel what kind of sentiments, what kind of ethos. Indians, they call this bhava and rasa. So there's a great dynamic in really tapping into what this mode can offer you as far as emotions. This is a very, very important part of these ancient musical cultures we're talking about, that we hold the tail end of it in the West. I'm not saying that music in the West is not emotional.
What I'd like to do now is to take, given that we've set up these kind of differences, talk a little bit more maybe about your practice and how you create sound environments that actively mm-hmm. mobilize some of these, you know, ancient principles in a new tongue, if you will. And then in addition, how the question of listening, how the listener, him and herself, also have a role to play in uncovering this kind of world of intonation and its capacities to shift and expand consciousness.
Mm-hmm. They certainly do have an important role, and it's the most important role, which is having the awareness of what to do with the sound. And that's something that we don't really have so much in the West, except when you deal with jazz, for example. A lot of people who don't understand jazz, don't know how to listen to it, they don't like it, because it sounds to them as chaos. But once they start learning about how to listen to Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, and so on, then they start to figure out, and what they have then is the awareness, the knowledge of form, of improvisation, of jazz harmonies and jazz use of rhythm. So when I work with people, And I don't call this practice sound healing, although it's widely known as sound healing, mainly because I don't find this term to be exact and fair. Why? Well, because sound healers, or I'd like to call them sound practitioners, sound therapists, that's more appropriate of a term. They need to know a lot, and unfortunately, there are very, very few schools, I can think of only two in the United States, that can train people, giving them a certain number of hours, between 100 and 150 tops, to get a certificate in this practice. Usually, a lot of people end up by taking a workshop over a day, an afternoon, or a couple of days, or 2 weeks, which is not enough to cover what one needs to know about sound. So sound healing is misleading as a term, because most people think that, okay, they go and get a session with a sound healer. They sit down and the sound healer plays the instrument that they usually play, which are overtone-emitting instruments for the most part, such as gongs, Himalayan singing bowls, didgeridoo, some singing, crystal bowls, discs, bells, and so on. And the person sits down and receives the sound. They don't explain what the listener needs to do. The listener needs to be an active participant. This is where the magic happens, is what is the listener doing? How is the listener listening to the actual sounds coming out? What are they doing with their mind? What's happening in their mind? And as we know, the monkey mind is hard to stop. That in any practice, this discursive thinking is in our head distracting us to small extent or to great extent. So when I work with people, I tell them how to have the experience, what kind of judicious, intentional, attentive listening to apply in the experience, because it's truly the most important part. This judicious listening, and if people are not familiar with the term, judicious means having, exercising, or characterized by good or discriminating judgment, or wise, sensible, well-advised. So it's very important, and when this happens, the person is aware of the mental activity and would let go of these discursive thoughts and come back to the sound and follow the ethos. So the person is not going to be healed just because there's a skilled sound healer playing these instruments. You know, I use the term healing very, very carefully. I don't splurge with it seriously, and nowadays you find a lot of people using it left and right. We should take it a little more seriously, because it seems like the meaning is diminished now. We don't, healers don't heal others. They help people heal themselves. This is my definition of a healer, and I don't call myself a sound healer. Actually, I call myself sound therapist. My practice is called sound meditation, because I find that meditation is an inherent part of the practice. The person is not going to be healed by magic just because they're sitting in front of these instruments and there's someone playing them. So the most important part in my practice is telling the individual who's receiving the work what to do, what to listen for. So I explain the concept of ethos, and the ethos is something that emerges out of the intervallic structure of whatever mode you're using. So for example, if you're playing, let's say, C major scale, which is basically a formula that if you follow it, it'll allow you to construct a major scale starting on C or any other note, which is a whole step, half step, whole step, whole step, whole step, half step. Again, the whole step is two half steps. And basically, if you construct this, then the intervallic structure, what's more important than the notes, in any mode or scale, it's the distance, the interval between one note and another. The combination of all of these will give you the ethos. Ethos is spelled E-T-H-O-S. It's an ancient Greek word that's still in use, and it's borrowed in English. And it's basically the distance between the notes that construct the ethos. So there's a specific way of listening to the raga. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners have been to Indian classical music performances, And they see this dynamics that start to happen in an Indian music performance, how people react, because listening is participatory in these cultures. People communicate how they're feeling, what this music is doing to them, either through hand gesture, head gesture, or using stock of words and expressions. Same in Arabic and Persian and Turkish music. In Arabic culture, they're called samia, those who listen judiciously. And the performers highly rely on the presence of these judicious listeners to communicate to them that they're following, they're digging what they're doing. And this encourages the musicians to give more, because what they're looking for is this this dichotomy that exists between musicians and the audience would cease to exist, and it's the energetic connection. So I explain to people how to listen to the ethos, and I give examples, and I explain to them that the sound of this instrument and this mode that I'm using can influence the way they're feeling, can impact their emotion, because that's what sound does. It creates realities. It suggests realities. It induces various emotions. And another thing that I bring attention to is how to listen to the overtones. So a little bit about the overtones.
I just want to interrupt for a moment. We just have to take a break, because I know the overtones is a big part of it, and it's a lot of what people think of when they think about this kind of work. But we're going to take a break now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Alexander Tanous. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay, and we'll be right back after this.
This is PRN.FM. Tune in anytime for the latest in progressive news and ideas. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
It's the BRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul. And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Alexander Tanous, and he's talking to us now about the overtones, and particularly how to listen to overtones. I mean, I can speak as someone who also fell in love with the kind of music we've been talking about, drone music, Indian classical music, Arabic music, Persian music, and also just experimental music that plays with drones and plays with just intonation decades ago, partly because it became for me part of my own spiritual, psychedelic, experiential exploration of the world of sensation, of the world of the senses open and alive. And in that, there's this wonderful thing about overtones, about listening to the hidden higher frequencies, sometimes quite odd, that are folded into the sounds of a singing bowl or an open resonating string or a shruti box or something like that. And I've always wanted to know how to refine my capacity to pluck out and to recognize and appreciate those more distant, buried or enfolded overtones. So I'm very interested in hearing you riff on the overtones.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I'm going to try to keep it simple here because it can get technical. The overtone series, sometimes called harmonic series, And sometimes you find it used interchangeably with harmonic overtone series, although I should emphasize that there are harmonic overtones and enharmonic overtones, and they're different. But let's call them overtones now. So harmonic overtone series is one of the intelligent systems that are that we find in nature that manifests intelligence. We know that intelligence in nature manifests in mathematics. For example, fractal geometry, Fibonacci series or numbers, and the relevance of the golden mean, phi and pi, and so on. Harmonic series is one of them, and it's nature's blueprint to sound. Now, when we listen to any note, whether a note played on human-made instrument, human voice, or any sound from anything in nature, animal, bird, or sound of stream or wind, that note is not just one frequency. There is a fundamental frequency, and there are other higher frequencies that are sometimes inaudible, but they're part of the sound to give the sound its tone color or timbre. So, an example, if we're listening to a note played on a violin, let's say C note, that C note, if you were to use electronic equipment or specific software to show you what kind of overtones that are included in it, although you're listening to one, this software will give you the whole spectrum of what's included in there that you're not directly aware of. And you can actually pick one overtone at a time and play it. Some software can do this. Adobe Audition is one. Isotope RX, often used by sound engineers. And this C note on a violin obviously is going to sound different than the same register C played on an oboe or clarinet. And if you were to analyze the harmonic spectrum of the clarinet C note, you will find that it has a different harmonic series. Why? Because the coloring is different. So if there's a painter trying to paint the color of the sky, the painter is not going to pick just one blue color and put it on the canvas. The painter is going to compose different colors on the palette, a little bit of white, a little bit of pink, a little bit of gray, and so on, to give you an exact color. So to give you this color, one has to use different frequencies. So we can think of sound as being the same. Now, most of the time, we don't hear the overtones. We hear the end result, which is a very specific note that would give you a lot of information telling you what is playing this sound, not just the note. Now, we start to hear these overtones when we play the instruments that are often used in sound therapy or sound healing. Gongs, Himalayan singing bowls, metallic or you know, the contemporary crystal bowls, the djeridoos, juice harps. You can also sing them when you sing diaphonic singing, overtone singing, throat singing, they're more or less the same. You can also produce these overtones. So many instruments can introduce them, but it's fascinating that human beings started using these instruments for this practice. But I should mention as well that many cultures went after overtones and built instruments, even using plant material to build instruments that would give you the overtone. So there's an intuitive sense that would drive us toward the overtones. Some of these instruments that I've encountered in sub-Saharan music, for example, in sub-Saharan musical cultures, like the djil and the balafon, they look kind of like marimbas, mallet instruments that you would play, but then they create a system that would cause a buzzing to bring out the overtone. Some harps as well. Harps come from Africa originally. They had a bray system or various things to bring out the buzzing, which gives you the overtones. So humans didn't only seek overtones by using metallurgy, which is very complex chemistry, but they constructed instruments from plant material as well. So... The harmonic series, if you're playing a note, let's say C, That C is the fundamental frequency. This is the note that's going to sound most pronounced, and you may be hearing it as the only note on the instrument. But if you were to analyze the harmonic series of C, you'll find that there is a series above from it. The first overtone would be an octave higher C, 8 notes apart, where the frequency is doubling. And the second overtone would be a G, an octave and a fifth higher from the fundamental frequency. The third overtone will be another C, 2 octaves higher from the fundamental. And then an E and a G. And these intervals, starting with an octave, going on to fifth, fourth, major third, minor third, will go on to infinity. And they get smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, the tone color or the timbre comes out basically when you calculate how much of these overtones are found in that specific sound, how many of them are sounding, and to what level of strength and weakness. This eventually will give you a culmination of a very specific sound signature that would tell you this is a sound produced on a violin, and we recognize it as a violin sound, versus trombone, and trumpet, and piano, and human voice. So this is a very important aspect that gives us a lot of information. We must also remember that sound informs our senses on many levels, not only the nature of the instrument that's producing the sound, but also informs us about space. When you clap your hands in an empty apartment and you have your eyes closed, you can tell from by the way the sound is reverberating against the wall that there is no furniture in this apartment, or you can tell about how large the space approximately is. Or if someone is snapping his or her finger in front of your face, you can tell the direction of the sound, where it's coming from, how far the snapping is coming from, and so on. So sound also deals with space because it doesn't go directly to our ear. It bounces on the walls and on the ceiling and on the floor. Different objects sometimes is absorbed, sometimes comes back to us, refracting. So there's a great relationship between sound and space. And basically, this overtone series is very complex. Many of the notes, all of the notes, actually, except for the fundamental frequency and every time that occurs in the series, deviate. They're not in tune with a perfectly tuned piano. A lot of these overtones fluctuate by a few cents, higher or lower, or many cents, higher or lower. The most that fluctuates is 49 cents. Minus 49 cents. That's a greatly flat note. This is actually where the half flat comes from in Arabic and Persian and Turkish music, because they have half flats and half sharps and even notes between these intervals. So it's important to note here that the notes in the harmonic series are not perfectly in tune. They don't follow the equal-tempered notes. We are the ones who deviated from that. Just intonations come from the intonation that I found in the notes in the harmonic series, and they all fluctuate except for the fundamental frequency and every time it occurs in the series.
Now, no, I can't help but interrupt and just bring up, it's just been popping in my head all day. It's just, if you looked, people who are familiar with Thelonious Monk's playing, there's a peculiar quality, a sort of off, a little bit, quote unquote, out of tuneness to the way that he'll cluster notes in a solo. And one way of understanding what he's doing is that he's taking an equal tempered instrument and gesturing towards these microtones that you would find in other kinds of music, as if he's kind of pushing against the prison walls of equal temperament in order to open up the sound world.
Yes, absolutely.
Anyway, I didn't want to interrupt your train, but it was, it's good. We also have about 10 minutes left here, and so I would like to invite you in terms of having, we've established a little bit about the overtone world, how listening to overtones, the practice of learning to listen to overtones, how that actually triggers something that we might also refer to in terms of spirituality, in terms of trance states, in terms of these higher aesthetic potentials of the soul? What's the relation there with the listening to overtones?
Yeah, very good question. So basically, sound is a tool at the end. Sound is a tool for us to do things with. And the more awareness we have, the more knowledge. There is a prerequisite knowledge, and listening can come in a variety of different ways. When I work with people, I demonstrate the overtones and I tell them what is the best way to listen to them. So when you play Himalayan singing bowl, you have somewhere between 5 and 7 or 8 overtones that come out of it. Not all of them are audible. People will hear the most pronounced ones, the loudest ones, and sometimes the lowest in the register. So I bring awareness to the different register, that there are notes that are low in register, mid-register, and high register, different frequencies. There's another variable here, which is the dynamics. Some overtones are soft and some are loud. I also bring awareness to the fact that each overtone has different modulation. The modulation is the beat, the wobble, the wavering, the pulsating effect, like wow, 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 versus wow, 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 wow. So this would allow the person to distinguish that there's an overtone there, to focus one's awareness on it. And when one is doing so, one would need to do it by way of meditating. That means no more thoughts should happen. If a tangent thought comes to one's mind while listening, one would have to let go of it and come back to the sound. The more the mind quiets down, the more the person is able to hear these concealed overtones, either because they're high or very low in register, or they have very low dynamics, and to try to merge oneself in that overtone to gain the awareness, to go even in between the overtones. And very often when people use this method, they tell me that they get to a place where there's no more awareness of the self. They don't know where they are, what they're doing, who they are, how long the experience lasted. They become that which they're observing, the sound. So that's why I say sound is a tool. And the awareness of the listener, what the listener is doing, and the meditative skills that the listener has are the most important thing. And basically what happens at the end is that we start to vibrate sympathetically with music. We establish some state of resonance, and this is where healing is. I didn't mean to say earlier that there's no healing when working with sound. There is, but we cannot sell sound as a practice sound healing. It's like, come and be healed right away. No, this can happen, but many things can happen before that. And also, we shouldn't forget that there's a lot of revealing and healing, and there's a lot of healing in revealing. Very often we just combine all of it and we use one term, healing. Well, when we are in a deep meditative state or we're having an experience, consciousness, and a certain realm in the invisible landscape and the higher self, the spirit world, whatever you want to call it, is being revealed, informing us that we're not just who we think we are. That's revealing, and there is healing. There is snapping out of baseline. There is an added awareness here that's expanding our consciousness through this awareness. So what happens when we deal with overtone emitting instruments, and I've done a lot of EEG studies, people can see them on my website, which is soundmeditation.com, and I'm writing a book about all of this. It's maybe out next year, because I want to write a book that's not an academic book that everyone can read, but unfortunately it's really hard because you deal with a lot of technical things. And because sound is a powerful tool, one has to use a multidisciplinary approach to better understand it, using physics, mathematics, neuroscience, ethnomusicology, psychology, and so on. So it's very important to know how to listen to these overtones, to learn something about the self. And very often when people are in deep meditative state and the mind is quiet down, people become aware of something that it wasn't there. These higher frequencies in the overtones, very concealed, they become apparent. They become, sound is a dimension. It's a dimension that deals with non-material world. And this is basically what affects us when we listen to music. We subconsciously sense healing, a distraction on the most fundamental level, changing our emotional state through the ethos, quieting the discursive thinking, and it does impact so much the electrical activities in the brain. It impacts the autonomic nervous system, parasympathetic and sympathetic. It impacts the vagus nerve. And a lot of these elements are very important when it comes to healing and snapping out of baseline, snapping out of these habitual patterns and bringing things to resonance, allowing the body to reinstate its original state, allowing the body to heal itself. You see how healing comes from within, not from the healer.
Yeah, that's all very well said. And, you know, for some reason, what's popping up in my head at the same time is, you know, you mentioned earlier the way that major religions strongly deployed the mm-hmm. power of sound to sort of, you know, both provide followers with ecstatic experiences, but also in some sense to kind of control the spaces that that people moved within. There's a mm-hmm. politics behind all the things you're talking about as well. And my only two cents here is that in addition to the sort of healing and spiritual components that you're pointing to, the practice of listening in the broad sense, inclusive of meditation, inclusive of deep listening, deep and informed listening to music, like you want to listen to jazz, well, learn some theory. It's not that hard. It's like math. It's kind of fun and it's kind of tedious and you can do something with it. But also just in terms of listening to the world around you, that becoming aware of these subtler dimensions of listening, in my experience, also kind of forces you to recognize how much our given sound world in modernity is debased in a variety of ways, and that can actually be a very insightful angle into understanding how our society is organized, how it's controlled, because people don't pay as much attention to it in comparison to vision and to text, to moving image, et cetera, but it actually reveals a great deal about our political situation. You know, sharing this world with others, as well as the capacities of our own nervous system and our own hearts to resonate with these higher principles.
Yes, absolutely. Sound has been castrated and modified and limited in a wide variety of different ways. And it's been capitalized on, and it's been driven to shallow level. I mean, it's what happens with cheap pop music, telling people music that does not expand their consciousness. And people can buy into just about anything, but it takes some effort on behalf of the listener to sift out the good from the bad and to realize that it's also a lot of the listeners who are interested in sound. Please be careful when you surf the internet and watch YouTube videos, because there's a lot of disinformation, misinformation, and a lot of theories that are based on wishful thinking, wishful believing, hokey, hooey stuff that are becoming standard, and people are starting to believe these things. You have to be super careful. Most of what's out there about sound is wrong, whether intentionally or unintentionally. We have to be careful with our passion, not to generate gullibility and desperateness in just buying into just about anything.
Because here, Alexander, I really appreciate you underscoring that. It's one of the longstanding themes of this show, and particularly when you're thinking about sound healing, maybe in other zones there's more room for a variety of kinds of thinking about what's going on cosmologically, metaphysically, maybe in the realm of healing in general. There's a lot of complexities. But one thing you can mm-hmm. say about sound and musicology and ethnomusicology is that they are robust and rigorous systems, that while they may be limited in certain ways, you know, opening mm-hmm. to the spiritual or whatever, that there's a tremendous richness and vitality and coherence and rationality to these descriptions and to these machines. So the fact that you can, you know, use an advanced digital device that is excellent, like all digital devices, at quantizing, at mm-hmm. rendering things into quantities, which in some sense is the world we want to move away from. The fact that these devices can do that and can reveal these overtones, these subtle overtones that then we can reintegrate into our own listening, creating a larger, more integrated feedback loop, is a sign of how much science and and mathematics and rationality and the academy to some degree can inform these very exploratory zones as your work is done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I use all the tools available to us, all the disciplines to gain a better understanding. Now, I'm not someone who just relies on science. I do agree with Victor Hugo's statement that science has the first answer on everything and the last answer on nothing. I use a lot of the knowledge that I and the data that I've acquired in my fieldwork in over 40 countries, and my personal experiences, my training in music, which, you know, lasted 12 years. I have 4 degrees in music. My experience playing various musical cultures, different instruments, different styles and genres, and very important, my work with close to 9,000 people now, people who shared with me their experience, gave me feedback on how they were impacted, which is a very important way to understand how sound impacts people who have different conditioning. I am conditioned when it comes to sound, but I'm interested in knowing how someone else who has a different conditioning, who listens in a different way, is experiencing this. And
great. Alexander, you know what? We're going to have to wrap it up there. We reached the end of our allotted time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure. Great to be on the show, Eric.
Great. I want to let everybody know that Alexander's website is soundmeditation.com. There's lots of further information about his doings there. And one last reminder from me, keep your minds open.